just a simple form that you could fill out that would reduce your property tax bill by 25% in perpetuity. No one said anything about it. So I didn't know about it. And now my property tax bill is 25% higher than it would have been had I filled out that form in the first year of ownership.
I can't even remember what we agreed to 3 or 4 years when it goes by. You have to put it in writing, and it has to be right, and it has to be in writing every single time. It can't be this handshake deal. So anything that's not in writing doesn't exist.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. It's another Thursday, so it's just Ryan and I, your best buds, John, about real estate and a bunch of different topics. How you doing, Ryan?
I'm excited to get vulnerable and submit my identified, not my de-identified, but my identified ASAP report about real estate investing and all the mistakes that I've made in real estate investing. Not all of them, but it probably take 15 hours to go through all the mistakes I've made, but kind of the big ones that I think our listeners will love to hear about.
I love it. And obviously this is all in an effort to learn and grow because, you know, we always say in the business world that there's no such thing as failure. You either succeed or you learn, right?
That's right. And, you know, for those that are listening that don't know aviation or what an ASAP report is, Pilots Out, we have one of the coolest programs ever, which is a joint effort between the FAA, the union, and the pilot. And management, I should say, to submit an ASAP report, which is an aviation safety action program, which basically says if you make a mistake or you see anything safety related, you can report it. And then you sort of have this report that people can read, the FAA management and the union, and then they can get that implemented better into training. They can do like a memo or a bulletin that kind of speaks to the thing that happened and it's sort of a lessons learned to capture. And the pilot gets the opportunity to kind of confess, you know, hey, this is what I saw, or point out a safety issue. And then they don't have any punitive action taken against them. So it increases the volume of reporting that comes to the airline and it makes it safer over time. So, you know, accidents, you know, back in the day, regulations were written in blood. They're no longer written in blood anymore because, well, sometimes they are, but because really there's not a lot of aviation fatalities. It's actually very safe. So in order to get the inside scoop, it's what's going on, you know, ASAP has been very powerful. So we want to make a little ASAP episode of real estate investing or just investing in general and all the things that we've learned from the years of making mistakes. So
I love it. Ryan, you want to go first?
Sure. I'd love to go first.
All right.
So my first lesson learned is listen to your wife. Your wife makes better investment decisions than you do, and have a plan, strategy. So in 2014, I was leaving the regional airlines and I heard about this thing called the self-directed IRA, which is great. I converted my Air Wisconsin 401k into a self-directed IRA and I was loaded for bear. And man, the first person that walked in the door I was going to invest with. And that was my mentality. It didn't matter who it was. It could have been Bernie Madoff or it could have been Steve Schwartzman. It didn't matter. I was investing with that person.
Yeah.
So I am on Facebook. And I see this guy and he's talking about how he's the apartment guy and he goes around and buys these apartments and he's got all this experience and you can invest with him and you don't need to spend millions of dollars on an apartment. You can invest as little as $50K to buy an apartment. And it's self-directed IRA approved, right? Mm. And so I looked at that and I was like, oh my God, I have a self-directed IRA. It's like Facebook knew what I was looking for and it put this ad in front of me. And so I
to be fair, everything is self-directed IRA approved.
Exactly. Yeah.
Every syndicator takes. So big whoop.
So it's funny in the disclaimers on every syndication, it says this is neither approved or disapproved by the SEC. The SEC is basically taking the position of you filed the exemption, like don't screw it up. Like they're not blessing or they don't approve these syndications, right? Unless you're investing with a registered security. And like IRAs, you can use for any traditional or non-traditional assets if you're a self-directed custodian, right? We have a different episode on that with Kerry Cook. You can listen to that episode. I think it's like episode 8 or something like that. So it's such a gimmick. It's a gimmick to try to convince you, oh, it's approved for IRAs. Like who approved it? Well, nobody, because there is no approval process for that. So anyway, I fill out the form. I get the sales guy on the phone and I get the full, I mean, I was already sold before I pick up the phone. I was just hot to trot. I was going to invest and I made a bunch of mistakes on that. And the deal ended up being a Ponzi scheme. And so the investor was, or the syndicator was taking the money. And I noticed he posted a Maserati the day after the property closed on Facebook. And then he took an around the world trip to Europe and other countries and live a lavish lifestyle. And sure enough, about 2 years into it, I actually called the syndicator and said, "Hey man, I know what you're doing. And I like, I'm full of your sick of your excuses. Can I just have my money back?" And, you know, and he said, "No, you know, quit being a little whiner about it." And I said, "Okay." I filed with the state and he's in jail now. So, yeah, he got 10 years in prison.
What did the deal look like? How many units? Where was it?
Yeah. So it was a, well, one of the deals, so I did two deals actually with them. One paid out. One was a, I think it was like a 30 unit apartment complex in Phoenix, pretty straight down the, and these deals were just basic deals. They weren't super complicated deals, 30 unit apartment building in Phoenix. And then the other deal was a, it was a 2 acre or two parcel deal that he was subdividing into multiple lot and then either building houses and selling or just selling the lots as entitled lots.
And was that the one that went bad?
That one went bad. And, you knew it was bad when, you know, we all remember residential real estate, like totally exploded during COVID, like prices were going through the roof. And we got this email from him saying like, "Oh, you know, COVID's like really impacting my ability to sell these lots." And that's when I knew, I was like, "Oh my God, residential is exploding right now. And you're saying you can't sell residential lots." Like people are.
So this was in 2020?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Okay. I invested in 2015 and then the deal was supposed to be 18 months.
Gotcha.
For years. So
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, lessons learned there is, you know, I think my grandfather has a famous saying, you know, money makes the blind man see. You can interpret that a lot of different ways. Like I was just looking for those yields and I saw him and I was like, all I could see was this guy and what he had. And that's what I wanted to do. And so my wife, she had wanted nothing to do with this deal. She told me not to do this deal. She was upset about it and she was absolutely right. So invest with your wife. I made like lots of mistakes there that I won't make again. And, so yeah. So if you're doing due diligence on a syndicator, I mean, here's my criteria now. I have to know you for a couple of years before I'm going to put money in it. And this doesn't have to be your criteria, but this is just kind of my criteria. I need to know you personally. I need to get to know you a little bit more, whether that's in person or at a conference or over multiple phone calls. I need to kind of interview you. I want to do a background check. And that just could be as simple as putting your name in Google. Yep. And if you notice anything like lack of payments or, you know, complaints about not getting paid or just SEC violations on the person's name, that's a pretty telltale sign that you probably shouldn't invest with the person or if they have pending lawsuits, things like that.
Yep.
Yeah.
And this is what we do at Turbine is, I mean, we won't put any money on our platform. We won't put any deal on our platform unless we know a syndicator very well. You know, we have a multifamily deal coming up. Actually, it's probably closed by the time this episode airs, but it's the first time that we're working with this syndicator, but I've actually known him personally for 6 years. We're in a mastermind together. I've seen his work. We've dug into their track record. So this is something as a fund we take extremely seriously. But yeah, if you're investing direct to operator, just what Ryan said, you know, really do your homework on who you're investing with.
Yeah. And again, this was my very first deal I've ever done in real estate outside of like my own real estate. But the other thing too was when I jumped on a call with him, I had a list of questions. You know, I read every single document, all 100, you know, 50 pages of the PPM. And I had some very
private placement memorandum.
Yes. That's like the private placement memorandum. We could do a whole show on the documents for syndications, but it basically outlines all your risks and it kind of gives the whole business plan. And so I had a bunch of questions on it and I called him and I said, "Hey, I got some questions on this." And I started answering the questions and you know what he said to me? He said, "You know, I haven't even read that thing. So I don't even know what's really in there." That's a red flag.
That's a red flag. That's a red flag.
Yeah. I was like, you know, he's like, "Wow, Ryan, you're
I don't
really
even know what my legal documents say."
Yeah. like, it's like, I think this is, you know, in retrospect, again, I was just, money made the blind man see. I just saw the return. Yeah. I saw the deal. I wanted to get the money placed. Money was out of the stock market. I wanted to get it into real estate, and nothing was going to stop me. And so that was a red flag. And then, you know, I had a lot of questions about how the language was strongly written in his favor. And when I was pressing him against that, he said, you know what, Ryan, this is what it says, but you just have to trust what I'm doing to be in the best interest of the deal, you know? And it was sort of like, just ignore what's written on paper and just trust me. Right. And that was a huge red flag for me. What's written in paper really matters, right? Like what the operator has stated in their documents makes a huge difference. And, you know, people always say a handshake deal and all that. I don't believe in any of that stuff, because here's the thing. Right. I can't even remember what we agreed to 3 or 4 years when it goes by. You have to put it in writing, and it has to be right. And it has to be in writing every single time. It can't be this handshake deal. So anything that's not in writing doesn't exist. And get to know your operators. Don't just see the person on Facebook and invest.
I like it.
You know, get, yeah.
Well, I got a similar one. That I actually hadn't thought of before this episode until you just brought that up. This was actually my first passive deal, and I had forgotten about this. I think conveniently forgotten about it. This was a development deal in Hawaii, which, you know, we probably at some point will talk more about this. But if you look at the sort of risk spectrum in commercial real estate, you know, the lower left-hand side of the graph is what we would call core, where you're just buying a coupon clip, you're buying property that's already stabilized, you're not going to do anything with it, you're just going to buy it and it's going to cash flow. That's it. That's core. Then we get up into core plus and value add. Value add would be buying an existing asset that needs work, or that you think that you can bring income up or bring expenses down and create more value out of an existing asset. And then there's opportunistic up in the upper right-hand side of that graph, which is typically development. Now, development can be fantastic, but it carries the most risk, because there's, depending on what phase you're in, you know, the first phase would be entitlement, then there's permitting, then there's execution just in terms of construction, then there's lease up risk, where, you know, you actually have to lease it up if it's for rent, or you have to sell it if they're condos like this was. Well, we got caught up in the entitlement phase, and this is something that I didn't even understand back then, that, you know, getting into a development pre-entitlement is kind of the where the most risk lies.
It's like way off the charts of risk.
Way off the charts. That's right. Way off the charts.
Entitlement risk is like, you don't even know what you can do with the property yet, technically, with entitlement risk. It's huge. I'm a developer, so I build from the ground up quite a bit. So I have a lot of experience in this.
Yep. Well, in any case, we hit bones. And, you know, that
like literal bones?
Literal bones, ancient,
like dead Hawaiian bodies,
remnants, ancient Hawaiian remnants. You know, it was a burial site. And when you hit bones in Hawaii, I mean, everything stops. And so it was 2 years of working with the Office of Hawaiian Affairs to try and relocate them. And during that time, the project ran out of money, and there was a capital call, which is where they go back to the investors and say, hey, we want to keep this deal alive. We need to keep servicing the debt. So we need more money, which I ponied up for. Actually, it wasn't much. It was like $5,000 or something. But the deal essentially just died a slow death. And, you know, I think that actually still technically in that deal, I mean, it's been forever, but it hasn't sold. It's just completely overgrown with a big padlock on the fence. So, and the operator is, you know, I just didn't do my due diligence. He doesn't have a great track record. If you Google him, you know, some projects did okay. The bunch of other ones stalled, just doesn't have a real solid team behind him. And so anyway, learned my lesson the hard way on that one.
Yeah. And if you're in one of these, if you're listening and you're in one of these deals, just email us. We're happy to work through it, because there's things that you can do. There's reports you can file with the state that can come after these types of people. If you feel like there's fraudulent activity, or if the person's being unscrupulous. And that's what I did. It was interesting. I actually was on a flight from Washington, D.C. to Seattle. And I sit down, I was on an Alaska Airlines flight, like Alaska 3 or something, going back home. And I'm in the back, and I sit down, and I actually sat down next to the Department of Financial Institutions, the DFI. Ha! And I was just feeling friendly, and I had a conversation. I was like, you know, you coming home from work, live in Seattle? She's like, yeah, I'm going back. I was like, oh, where do you work? Oh, I work for the DFI. Oh, the Department of Financial Institutions. She's like, yes. How did you know? I was like, well, I'm a syndicator. She goes, this is going to be an interesting flight. So I bent the ear of the, not the SEC, but you know, the state regulator on this stuff for like 4.5 hours or 5 hours, whatever the flight was back. And very enlightening about just how many schemes and Ponzi's and all kinds of stuff.
It's unreal. That's out there. I'm surprised to hear that because, I think the key here is relationships. You know, every operator that we've ever worked with Turbine, and there's only been about six out of the thousands that we've come into contact with, but they've all been through relationships, met at conferences, are very well known in the real estate world. So I think if you just sort of find someone out in left field and you don't have any dots to connect to them, that's kind of a place where you should at least pause.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that I wanted to touch on too is, how to do due diligence on an operator. We do have an ebook on this, so I'm going to put that in the show notes. So if you want to read more about how to do due diligence, you can download our ebook.
It's a great book. I've read it. Short. Yeah. Short read. Good read.
Short to the point. But one of the things that I love in there is talking about how to get referrals because, are kind of setting up your interview. So like, let's say you find an operator, you don't know who they are, but they were recommended to you or whatever, and you want to interview them. There's a whole process for that. You know, what questions to ask and, what things you should, how you should structure your interview, ask open-ended questions, really get them talking, kind of take them down the road of what they do and then ask them for examples of what they just told you they do. Like, for example, how often do you update your investors? Well, if they say, I update my investors once a month. Okay. And how do you share bad news with your investors? Well, I'll share it with them right away. And then, how frequently do you communicate? Whatever it might be. And then say, hey, as a follow-up, can you just send me your last three investor communications and maybe send me the ones where you talk about the bad news, or ask them what their worst deal was, and then ask for the communications that were sent out for that worst deal. You're putting up your money, you're putting up your hard-earned dollars. I mean, people are like, well, what if the syndicator doesn't want to give me that stuff? Then go find another syndicator. There's 19,000 deals like this every year, and you may be like, well, I only know like a handful. Okay, well, you need to get your deal flow up, right, and find more operators, which that book talks about. How to expand your network, right? And so again, it's really important just to get your deal flow up on these syndications of these passive investments so that you can kind of learn more about what's out there and kind of how to evaluate them a little bit better. But the last thing I love is asking for referrals. And this can be applicable to anybody in your life. I mean, how many times have you been asked for a referral? Hey, I need three references for your job. I mean, it's not like you're going to send them the mechanic you pissed off on your last airline or the flight attendant that hates you or the guy you couldn't stand to fly with for 4 days, right? You're gonna send, the guy that's
a raving fan.
Favorable, the guy that's gonna say, hey, yeah, just write your reference and I'll sign the bottom, right? Like you're gonna send them the person you love. So the best referrals that you can get are people that aren't provided to you by that person, right? So you can try to find other people who have invested with that person or like contractors. I always
call Jeremy Roll. He's invested with everyone.
call Jeremy Roll. He's on episode he's
hundreds. I don't remember, like, but he's back there. Yeah. Jeremy's amazing. Yeah. But I'm sorry, contractors.
Yeah. So like when we were hiring our contractor for a big self-storage job, we asked them, okay, who are your suppliers? Oh, this building supplier and this contractor. So we called the subcontractors without them knowing and just said, hey, what's it like working with these guys? Oh, they're great. Show up to the job site. It's clean. They're ready to accept our materials, And so that was more telling to us than the contractor's references to the people that are, of course, going to speak highly favorable of that contractor, right? So you can glean a lot by trying to find references that the operator doesn't give you. So
and that's a perfect transition to some mistakes that we've made in our active real estate, because that's a perfect tool to use if you're hiring a contractor. There's a free tip. Call some subs. Yep. See how they liked them. Also, don't pay contractors in advance. I have not made that mistake, but I've heard of people making that mistake.
Yeah,
paying 100% up front and then they just disappear. So don't be that person. Ryan, what are some mistakes that you've made in your active investing career that you're wiser for now?
Well, where do I start?
I can go first if you need.
Yeah, why don't you go first? Because I have so many. I don't even know where to lean in on this. And that's the thing. People are like, oh, what's your, you know, do you guys ever make any mistakes or whatever? Oh my God, every day is a new mistake that we have to overcome. So if somebody tells you that they have a flawless real estate career, they're definitely full of crap. So yeah, but go ahead, take 100%. Kick us off. Yeah.
One that just comes to mind. I mean, there's a ton of mistakes that I made when I bought my first multifamily property, which was I was underprepared for the leap from residential to commercial, because anything over four units is now commercial. So quick overview of the difference between debt. When you buy a residential property, meaning one to four units, single family home, duplex, triplex, quad, those are amazing investments because you can use a residential mortgage to buy that. And a residential mortgage is really easy to get. When you go to five units and over, you're now in this commercial lending world, which the opposite of a jumbo loan, the smaller the loan balance that you go, the harder it is to get. So to give you an example, if you're looking for agency debt, Freddie, Franny, anything between $1 million and $5 million of loan balance is considered small balance. And anything below that, almost no one will touch except for local banks. And if you're investing out of state, it can be very difficult for you to get a loan if you have an out-of-state driver's license. So this is what happened to me when I went to South Carolina, was put this property, this amazing deal under contract, and went to a bunch of local banks. And it, worse than just saying flat out no, three banks gave me the slow no, like, yeah, I think so, you know, and gave me a term sheet and everything. And when it came time to close, yanked it. And I said, nah, I'm sorry, you don't have a South Carolina driver's license. You know, we're not comfortable with your track record here and you might disappear. It's like, well, what are you talking about? Like, I live in the United States. You have my social security number, you know, but it can be very, very difficult to work with small out-of-state local banks. If you don't have a pre-existing relationship with them, it becomes much more a relationship business. So that was the first mistake there, was I got my back up against a wall and I had to go after hard money to take down this property at, and this was, gosh, I don't know, 6 years ago or something. And it was at 9%, astronomical for the time, but it still worked. The numbers were fantastic with this thing. The next mistake I made was not realizing that property, there was a form that you could fill out in South Carolina. And my lender didn't tell me this, my property manager didn't tell me this, and my broker didn't tell me this, that you, property tax is really high in South Carolina. It's like Texas. Just a simple form that you could fill out that would reduce your property tax bill by 25% in perpetuity. No one said anything about it. So I didn't know about it. And now my property tax bill is 25% higher than it would have been had I filled out that form in the first year of ownership. So that's
amazing.
That was a hard lesson.
It's so important. If you are not getting a notice in the, so I'm gonna layer onto this. I got a 300% tax increase on a property.
Oof. Is this Texas?
Yes.
Yep.
And they sent the notice to the wrong property address. So we never got the notice. And then we figured it out later when they had made the decision, right? Because normally when they do that, they send out a notice and they say, hey, your property taxes are going to go up. If you want to fight it, here's how you fight it, whatever. And then some time goes by. And if you don't fight it, it's like decided, right?
And it's set in stone.
Yeah. And so the county didn't send the notice to the correct address. It went to some other address. Too bad, so sad. So if you're not getting a property tax notice in the mail every year, you're probably not getting the right mail. So like, if you don't get that, like just assume your property taxes are going to go up every year and fight it like hell.
So if you own a property out of state, how do you reach out to somebody? Who do you contact? Just for someone out there who owns a rental property out of state, they're like, oh my God, I haven't seen anything in a while.
There's always a tax assessor's office in every county. It's not a special thing. There's always a tax assessor's office. There's always, you know, a recorder of deeds or a tax assessor's website you can go on. You can put in your property address and you can see what the dispute process is, and you can probably see any pending increases on your property. Just make sure your mailing address, usually you can click into the tax assessor's site and you can see what your listed mailing address is to make sure that the mail is coming to the right address. We fought it and still got it reduced significantly from that 300%, but man, But I'll conclude this episode with a lesson learned. Hire fast and fire faster. And some people, you know, when you're first getting into real estate, you have a very provincial mindset. You feel like there's only one contractor on the planet. You only feel like there's one deal you can do. You only feel like there's one real estate agent. There's one broker. There's one. And if you screw up a reputation with one of those people, it's like the end of your reputation. And that just, it's the furthest thing from the truth. So the very first condo development project we did in Washington, D.C. was a disaster because the contractor was absolutely god awful terrible. And let me tell you how much time you will waste chasing around a bad contractor and just not doing your next deal. And when you're looking at a contractor, you know, one lesson I learned is listen to this. There's no magic in contractors. They don't pull a rabbit out of the hat and come up with better pricing. Like, the pricing is what the pricing is. Get over it. So like when we bid a big job, like we build, you know, 120, 130,000 square foot self-storage facilities. Now we built a 217 mobile home community in Washington. We build all over the country. And here's the reality. A general contractor is all they're going to do is take your plan set. They're going to go out to subcontractors. They're going to get a bunch of bids, and then they're going to take a profit on top of the total cost, right? That's a general rule of thumb. If you're trying to squeeze and find the cheapest contractor, you're going to get the cheapest result. So generally, when you put a project out for bid, let's say it's a $10 million job or a $1 million job, you should get four or five bids. They're all going to be about the same. They should be about the same. The guy that's really high has thought about something maybe you haven't, and the guy that's really low isn't including something in the bid that should be. And so it's your job to figure out what is the high guy done differently. And what is the low guy not included? Because at the end of the day, you're gonna fail if you don't figure that out. So so our job, you know, we felt like we only had one contractor to choose from, and there wasn't a better one, and the other ones were more expensive, and all that other stuff. So we went with the cheap guy, and we got cheap results. I mean, and he wasn't paying his subs, and they were coming in and they lit the building on fire. They
what?
Yes.
Wait, tell this whole story. Tell this story. We gotta hear this.
They lit the building on fire. One night they broke it and broke all of our plumbing, PVC piping. It was crazy. Yeah, we bought this row house in Washington, D.C. There's a single family row house in our nation's capital. We converted it into four condos. And, you know, the contractor had built previous houses and flips for us and did a pretty good job. But man, he was in way over his tips on this job. And the lesson learned is maybe he was been an okay contractor, but we should have fired him faster. And the problem is you get halfway through a project and you don't want to go through the pain of stopping the project and getting a new guy to do the deal. And that's kind of the lesson learned on that one. I think for us is we should have just stopped what we're doing, coughed up extra money and found somebody to do it right. And eventually we had drywall, you know, we were almost to the finish line. We had drywall in and everything, and somebody broke into the property and lit it on fire. And I got a call in Hawaii.
You were getting paid. Actually.
Yeah, probably they probably weren't. You know, we don't really know. We don't know what happened, but you know, I can read between the lines. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody went in there, they lit a fire, burned the building down. I got a call. I was in a layover. This is back when I was on the 7ER, as in Hawaii, on IOE, I think. And I'm at dinner. You know, I'm at dinner in Hawaii, so it's like, I don't know, 8 o'clock in Hawaii, but like it's 2 o'clock in the morning back in DC or whatever, right?
Right.
And I get a call and it's like, dude, your building's on fire. And I'm like, what? And so I had a project manager that lived a block away, is one of the investors actually too. And the building was on fire. And
how did this work out with insurance and everything?
Well, we did the insurance claim. You know, they coughed up the money to rebuild it. We got the project built and done. But man, I was flying to DC like once a week to babysit this thing to the finish line. And the opportunity cost that we missed by screwing around with that project as long as we did were just far greater than the $100,000 or $200,000 more we could have paid had we not, you know, done it correctly. And then when the building was built and delivered to the residents that bought the unit, you know, they had all kinds of maintenance issues, and we did the right thing. We said, you know what? We're going to write you a check, $200,000. And they went and managed all the repairs, and we washed our hands of the project. But man, it was it was a nightmare. And it all stemmed from just having bad people. So we only work with good people now. I mean, we're not in the game of trying to squeeze an extra penny out of it. Like when we built our big project in Seattle, or just south of Seattle, you know, we had the same situation where bids were coming in high, but they were all the same, except one guy was much lower. And, you know, I'll never forget the contractor, really, really reputable firm here in Seattle. I said, you know, that guy's low, but he's not including something in his bid, and he's going to charge you for it anyway, right? When it comes up, it's going to be a change order. And, you know, it's not, and there's blood from a stone. These contractors only have so much money, so they're going to carry what they need. Right. But, you know, Tate, you really brought up a good point about paying contractors. I want to address this. People think they have to put down some hearty deposit, and that's just the furthest thing from the truth. You don't have to put up a deposit for a contractor, right?
Well, then usually the argument is, I need money for materials, and you don't have to let the contractor buy the materials either, which it puts more work on your plate because then you're responsible for getting the materials and making them show up at the job site on time. And, you know, everything's correct. Yeah. So it might be a little bit outside the wheelhouse of some people, but you do not actually have to let the contractor buy the materials. In fact, the contractor usually marks them up. And that's usually the excuse is, hey, I need money up front because I got to go buy materials.
Yeah. And that's just the fastest way to lose money. And, you know, the other thing is always have a contract and agreement. Always have a scope of work. And the other thing that you want to think about is retainage. Retainage is, or maybe I'm saying that wrong, retainage or retainage is basically hold back, right? So let's say you spend $50,000 on a home renovation and you get to the last little bit of the project. And that's where everything comes to a grinding halt because nobody wants to come back and align your mirror a little bit better, right? They don't want to do that. So retainage is like a 10% hold back. So it's a $50,000 job, but you're going to hold $5,000 back until the job is finished. And that's always something you want to have in an agreement where it's like, yep, you can get that $5,000, but our punch list isn't finished. So come back and finish the punch list and I'll give you the $5,000. That keeps the contractor motivated all the way to the end. And that's a big lesson learned over the years. And lastly, lien waivers. If you don't know what a lien waiver is, I'm not going to go into a huge detail, but just know if you're doing a big construction job or a commercial real estate, get a lien waiver. That basically excuses any, and ideally you want a lien waiver from your general contractor who's going to say that I've paid all my subs. And then you also want to get a lien waiver in a big commercial job from all the subcontractors as part of that lien waiver. So basically the metal guy, the steel guy, the foundation, the civil contractor, whatever, they're all saying, hey, I've been paid up and I'm not going to file any liens against your property.
Right. And this is after things are finished. Yeah, you know, you go around and get before, those.
Yeah, this is before you pay a contractor, right? Because usually like a big job, like a $10 million job, you'll have like five $2 million draws, let's just say. So like they finish $2 million worth of work and then you pay them, right? And so before you actually transact with them, you get them to sign a lien waiver to say, hey, everybody's been paid. It's kind of like a hostage situation, right? Like sign this and I'll send you money. Right.
Right.
And so you have what's called an unconditional and a conditional lien waiver. They usually sign an unconditional lien waiver when they've been handed the money, and a conditional lien waiver saying, hey, we're conditionally saying that everybody's been paid up. So do lien waivers. And if you don't know about lien waivers, we don't have like time to go into a deep dive on that, but just know that they exist. And that's a way of assuring that the contractor later on isn't, or a subcontractor is not going to say, hey, I didn't get paid. You may have paid the contractor, but he didn't pay me. So I'm going to put a lien on your house. I'm going to cloud your title. So when you go to refinance your house, you won't be able to until I get paid. Right. And even though you did the right thing and paid your contractor and now you're in this dispute, right? If you have the lien waiver, you can say, that's a frivolous lien. And I want that scraped with this lien waiver. So that's what a lien waiver is. And it just look into that and make sure you're doing that, especially, you know, maybe on a small residential project, you're probably not going to get that, but like on a big job, you definitely want to get a lien waiver. So.
Excellent. Well, we've dug into some ASAP reports from Ryan and I on passive deals and active deals. I'm sure we'll have to do another one of these at some point because I certainly have some more mistakes that I could dive into. And I know Ryan, with your 100 plus employees and you know, close to $1 billion assets under management. I mean, your list is probably even longer than mine. So lots to learn. Thanks, everyone. Appreciate you listening in. We look forward to seeing you on the next one.
Catch you on the next episode.